Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. In the 25 years that I've been practicing as a psychotherapist, I'm pleased to say that society's come a very long way in smashing the stigma around mental health. Companies offer therapy to their staff. People speak openly about having a therapist. And from the royal family down, we are being encouraged to look out for those in our circle who might be struggling. But mental health issues are also political. Only in the last couple of weeks, we have been debating whether the government can cut benefits to encourage some of those off work through mental illness back into work. But what do you do when it's sometimes your work that affects your mental health? I was thinking about this most recently when I read last weekend about the harassment that Steve Baker, MP, received going about his constituency. I wanted to know how that affected him and to speak to him more broadly about how being an MP can affect you emotionally. So I am delighted to say that I am joined by Steve Baker, Conservative MP for Wickham and Minister of State for Northern Ireland. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Lucy. Thanks very much for having me on. It's with some trepidation that I surrender to an interview with a psychotherapist.
Oh, well, that's just too late. I've got you sussed already. My PhD thesis is already signed and sealed. So on that basis, I hope you'll still stay on my couch.
Of course I will.
But it's interesting that we're laughing already, but actually this is such a serious topic and you yourself have been through a lot of emotional ups and downs, actually. But I was wondering if you could take us back to what happened only less than a week ago, as long as you feel comfortable to do that, obviously. What was happening in your constituency? What were you doing and what did you end up having to deal with?
So I was out knocking on doors in the usual way with some of my activists. Obviously, the best way to reach people is to go and just meet them, ask them if there's any concerns they'd like to discuss and so on. It's a usual thing, and I consider it part of my democratic duty and right to go and meet people. So not for the first time, a young man appeared on the street with his camera held up. Hello, Mr. Baker. And I looked up and I said, and are you recording me? Yes, then I shall record you back, because I've kind of sussed this one. And the conversation evolved about Gaza, on which people have the very strongest views. However objectionable people may find it, I'm afraid there's a large section of our society who think that this is a genocide. And that was the line of questioning he was taking. And everyone can imagine that when someone thinks it's a genocide, they will have particularly strident views. So this went on for about 15 minutes, at which point I thought, you know, that's long enough being wandering down the street, being recorded. I've got no doors to knock on. And actually, I'm afraid we do have to take precautions. I've had death threats over the years, and you have to assume that a person might have a knife. So we're given a lone worker device, which you can press the button. It goes through to a control centre who can call the police. So I pressed the button and explained what I'd done and why, which is that you have to be prepared for escalation and death threats. And the conversation went on a little further. And it became clear to me that what he was doing was trying to stay the right side of the law whilst actively obstructing my duties. So he was very clear, I haven't threatened you, I've kept my distance. Both things were true. And it's okay because you're a public figure. But this isn't quite true. Public figures are subject to the law like everyone else in all regards, and we are entitled not to be subject to attempts to harass or intimidate us. That's not on.
And how did that resolve itself, in the sense that did they walk away? Did you just say, look, it's been 15 minutes now, I have to knock on people's doors, it's not appropriate for you to be there?
So it resolved itself by me doing the latter. I said, look, you know, I would ask you, plead with you to break off and let me continue knocking on doors. I can't reasonably ask people to talk to me on their doorstep when you're filming. And he, of course, did not break off, at which point I said to my activists, I'm going to have to break off because I can't continue. So I just walked back to my car and kept the video camera going and kept the control centre on the line. and got in the car and disappeared. It's not, of course, the first time. It's happened before. Somebody spotted me and he jumped out of his car. He had four of his cousins or uncles or whatever on a WhatsApp call, and he live streamed me on Facebook. Now, in a sense, I'm not that bothered. In a sense, this might be the weird, this is a weird thing. Because of all the events I've been through for 8 years, having a camera shoved in my face and questions asked, it doesn't bother me. Journalists do that all the time on the streets. And that's, in a sense, it's fair enough. But there comes a point where you're being obstructed from doing a job. And also, it's one thing to have, Sophie Ridge catch you on the way into Parliament one morning and ask a couple of questions. It's another to have somebody you don't know dressed in fairly aggressive clothes like combat boots and gloves and leather jacket and that, which I've got no objection to. It's just that they're fairly statement clothes. Asking you about a genocide and being fixated and obsessive. And once somebody's becoming fixated and obsessive, you have to start thinking, is this someone who could do me harm? And actually, we all owe it to our families to take precautions. So on the one hand, I take it for granted that in the age of social media, people are going to shove phones in our faces. And in a sense, it's fair enough. But it really is up to a point. And there comes
but the problem is you don't you always, it's all very well, now we know that what happened last Saturday didn't involve a weapon. But when you mention that someone can get close enough to try to put a mobile phone in your face, you don't know in that moment that there isn't also a knife, that there isn't also something else. And
that
mentioned
is true,
earlier, just a couple of moments ago, you said, I've been on the end of death threats, the receiving end of death threats. I mean, what does that do to you? How does that feel?
Well, see, the strange thing is, being ex-Air Force, I am fairly slow to get any kind of sense of alarm or anxiety because, well, you know, I'm ex-Air Force, you know, if you've been in the armed forces, I like to skydive. It's fairly last moment before I start thinking I've got to act. You know, I'm not particularly given to those sorts of stresses. However, what I particularly note is that the woman who threatened me with acid thought that she didn't really mean it. The man who talked about slitting my throat insisted he didn't really mean it. And the person who threatened me with hanging also thought that they didn't really mean it. And I consulted a retired judge, particularly about the guy who threatened me with my throat being slit. And I said to him, I don't think he really means it. I think he was using a metaphor in conversation. And he said, the trouble is with that, Steve, that's the sort of thing people say at the murder trial. We didn't think he meant it. And my only regret in that case is that I didn't, as the victim, didn't give the police the request to use the maximal disposal. I said I didn't want him to lose his job. So I said, I'd like the minimum disposal, please. And sometime later, I heard that he'd harassed another MP. So, I mean, the lesson from that, I'm afraid, is you just can't take any chances. But the tragedy is people make these threats, which do have a varying effect on MPs, and they think they don't mean it, and they think we're silly to take it seriously. But then everybody's consumed with grief and mourning when David Amos is murdered and Joe Cox before him. Stephen Timms was lucky to survive being stabbed. It's very serious.
And how vulnerable do you think MPs are now doing their constituency work? You've mentioned three incidents there, two which ended tragically. Is it getting worse? Is it that sense of imitation that people in a particular frame of mind think, well, I've seen that this happens. I've seen people harass MPs. I could do that, because they don't see you as human beings. They see you as objects. He's an MP, so I can do this to him. MPs vulnerable?
Yeah, I think so. But the lad on the street explicitly said, you're a public figure, so it's okay. So it was as if he knew that what he was doing wouldn't normally be acceptable. But because I'm a public figure, it is. And very worryingly, as I've obviously deliberately released this video, not only to get my own side out, but also to provoke this conversation. One member of parliament said to me that an activist online had been asking probing and inappropriate questions about her children. And that's obviously completely unacceptable. And when online my colleague pushed back, the activist said, well, it's okay because you're a public figure. And I'm starting to think these activists are being coached, that certain behaviours are lawful and that morally they can justify it to themselves because we're public figures. Now, there's quite a lot going on there. One thing is, who's doing the coaching? Sort of, I don't know, but since patterns of behaviour are repeating across the country, that suggests that there's a coordinated effort to cultivate particular behaviours and activists, and that's slightly worrying. But also, we just got to nip this in the bud. What kind of politics are we going to have if members of parliament are treated as fair game widely? Apart from the physical risk to individuals, the culture it will create will alienate, you know, the decent people who might like to stand for politics just won't.
And also the impact that it has on your families. I mean, it must be super stressful for your wife every time you leave the house, thinking, this is the kind of thing that happens at my husband's workplace, i.e. in the constituency.
I almost feel like I'm blessed indeed. My wife's pretty tough. She's ex-Air Force as well, and I don't wish to say much about my wife, but she's ex-Air Force as well and fully supportive of me and very stoical and very brave. But, you know, not all couples, and we don't have children as well, which is obviously means we got one less stressor. But I would just observe that this gives me an opportunity. The fact that I'm blessed indeed to have such a supportive wife and so on, and to be relatively robust myself, means that I've got the opportunity to provoke this conversation and take this battle to these activists, knowing that there's not much they can do that I fear in terms of escalation. And because obviously violence is criminal and the repercussions for them would be extreme. But we just can't have this. And certainly, I think with less robust people who aren't ex-forces or ex-police or whatever, who aren't used to being treated this way, you know, the stresses from it will be immense. I mean, we have had a full security package fitted at home now. If you count the Ring doorbell, I've got 9 cameras at home and a range of other measures taken. And it's just practical precautions. So you do feel you're living in Fort Knox, and unfortunately that it's necessary.
Par for the course, and does it really need to be that way? And then, interesting you use the word brave about your wife, because I think that you also wrote a very brave piece about a year ago about the impact that the work and some of the things that you'd been working on had on you, on your emotions. In fact, you even went so far as to say that you had felt suicidal, and I was wondering if you felt able to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I decided to talk about that for a couple of reasons, but preeminently to help other people. And it has done. I've had people come up to me on the street and say, thank you. The fact that you're recovering gives me the hope that I can recover. And it's been very moving. I must have had 3 people now say that I've saved their life. Well, I don't know whether I have, but they think I have. Yeah, so the whole business of 14 years in politics would be worth it just for that. Yeah, so that's very moving. But the reality is, going through the stresses of Brexit, I mean, for better or worse, I sat in the House of Commons with my phone in my hand and 130 MPs on a WhatsApp broadcast list, sometimes deciding at no notice which way the vote would go. And that is a stress that not even a Prime Minister carries. Normally, you know, a minister has collective responsibility and official support and all the rest of it. That was extremely stressful. You know, it is what it is. I'm sure it was very stressful for the public. And I just would emphasise to my opponents, I'm not asking for quarter, but if you ask me what happened, going through those kinds of burdens, which were historic, without any support, just was bound to be difficult. And then at the same time, the burden of people denouncing us as evil or corrupt and so on, very loudly and vehemently and repeatedly, in the end, that got through to me. I've noticed that people aren't very good when we disagree. Human beings are not very good at saying, I wonder if he might be right and I might be wrong. I wonder if it's possible to have a different perspective on this question. Maybe if I had different information and perhaps different preferences about the trade-offs involved, maybe I could see the other person's point of view. They don't do that. They think, I'm right, he's wrong. He's wrong because he's stupid or lazy or corrupt or evil. And then once they've told themselves he's stupid, lazy, corrupt or evil, then it's like weapons free, isn't it? They can justify to themselves saying anything. And once they're telling you that you're worthless and evil over and over again, you start to think, well, I'm worthless and evil. Mm-hmm. And once, if people look up the Beck depression inventory, which you'll know more about than me, go through those questions, I was scoring very, very high on those questions. So, you know, as a matter of course, I was thinking that I was, you know, worthless and possibly wicked. And, you know, that resulted in, you know, in a moment of mental health crisis, of anxiety and depression. I really needed a break after Brexit, after the 2019 general election. And unfortunately, of course, I didn't get one, because once we got into COVID, my colleagues prevailed on me to organise the COVID recovery group to protest excessive lockdowns and restrictions. And that was yet again, you can imagine the stress there, because that's now really life and literally life and death of millions of people. I'm proud that we were never called out by fact checkers. We had one inquiry by fact checkers, and after we explained our position, they kind of just dropped it and gave us a clean bill of health. But it took a lot of effort to make sure we could justify everything we said. And of course, people, again, they're telling us, you're putting my life at risk. So the stresses, again, were huge, but it's a choice. And again, I'm not asking for any quarter.
It goes back to this idea of objectification, where, as you were explaining during the Brexit days, that opponents would make their language or use their language in such a way that it dehumanizes people. I mean, I always thought that it was quite funny that there was a group known as the Spartans, of which I think you were one, but that makes you sound invincible, but you're not. You're human beings and you're trying the best as you see. And I think what happens a lot in political debate, and there's, you know, a conversation to be had about the adversarial nature of even just the House of Commons, that it inspires great oratory and it inspires perhaps the flying around of lots of ideas, but it does run the risk of exaggerating a depersonalization that is very unhealthy, and it makes it very hard for people to stay resilient with that constant onslaught, which, as you've described, was almost on a daily, maybe an hourly basis.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's continuous. I've just had to go on social media. But what you say must be right and certainly reflects my experience. I remember Karl von Clausewitz, a great theorist of war who we used to study in the Air Force, said war is the continuation of politics by other means. Well, I would invite people to turn that on its head. If war is the continuation of politics by other means, then politics is war minus the shooting. Now, that's how George Orwell described serious competitive sport. But it is war minus the shooting. And I would really say to anyone who's an aspiring political candidate, you do have to prepare yourself that it's war minus the shooting. I suppose the reason for provoking this conversation is to try and minimise the number of people who, in that great conflict for power and ideas, go too far. I would like people to moderate themselves. And we've got this, what's new and that's really changed over the 14 years I've been an MP is social media. Now, if somebody's angry and wants to tell you you're a worthless, evil, corrupt monster, they just leap on your Facebook page and tell you. And in the past, they would have had to write a physical letter, which might have made them pause and think. And it was much less immediate. But social media, Twitter, Facebook, and so on, means that angry, furious people can vent their feelings in anonymously. And I think all of that means that they can objectify us. But as I said in the article...
Yes, and funnily enough, I've been on the receiving end of that recently because of this debate about whether the government would cut benefits and try to encourage people with mental illness to get back into work. Because on the one hand, I'm incredibly grateful for how much work, as I said in my introduction, society has done in smashing the stigma around mental health. And yet in many cases, the structure of the workplace, the camaraderie of colleagues, the sense of purpose that one might have through one's employment or career, even the financial resources that you get, which are hopefully more than you would get on benefits, all of that can actually be really good for your mental health. Now, clearly, if someone does have, you know, the workplace can often be the playground and a lot of, you know, personality clashes can arise, or the work can be very stressful. But I was just wondering, to cut through that, there is no easy way to cut through it. That there are pros and cons on both sides, and I wonder where you stand on that.
Well, I just observe, you use the word camaraderie. That's, of course, where the Spartans thing came from. Mark and I were talking about what we were doing tactically. And Mark said, you know, we're going to be the Spartans. If necessary, we'll die in the pass defending what we believe in. And, you know, people might ridicule it or whatever, but that was about camaraderie. And it once leaked that I'd used the metaphor from The Great Escape about the duty of all officers being to seek to escape, etc. And people ridiculed that. But it was just about camaraderie and keeping people going when it was tough. Another example of that where it went terribly wrong. I embraced a journalist's joke at my expense. It wasn't my idea. It was somebody else's that I'd read on my Google alert. Brexit hard man Steve Baker. And it came after I'd been pictured on the Laura Koonsberg documentary with a tear on my cheek talking to a colleague. And it seemed funny to refer to it. But of course, it wasn't funny to all those people who were going through the mill in the public. And it was catnip to the press. And it's the worst mistake I've ever made because it's cost me 2,000 votes. And for good reason, those people are very angry with me. But, you know, so camaraderie, even in politics, camaraderie can backfire on you. Most people won't face what we face. Most people live private lives, not lives of public service. Most people are not engaged in fierce debate on the main issue of the day of life and death and the future direction of the country. I suppose, as a member of parliament, once I'd had a mental health crisis, I got excellent support from occupational health and from a psychiatrist, and eventually I took counselling. But my heart goes out to those people who don't get that support in their workplace. And we have done a lot. We've spent a lot on mental health support as a government. There's always going to be more to be done. But I suppose what I find really valuable is what you're doing, encouraging people to think about their mental health and to be very practical. Because like all things, prevention's better than cure. So,
Here's a radical thing. Well done for what you're doing. Is there any way, well, that's very kind of you, but I guarantee that your article will have reached many more people and in a way, because it maybe made people see politicians in a different light, would have had, you know, a really great impact. But is there any chance that we could have a general election that isn't about Rwanda, that isn't about necessarily the cost of living, although of course everything does go back to money, but if we could turn it into a mental health general election? Because my theory is that if you get mental health right, you get prisons right, you get education right, you get you help the burden on the NHS, you increase economic productivity, that actually mental health actually could really not even just tick boxes. It would ameliorate so many other problems in society.
Again, you must be right, but the chances of us having a decent, civilised general election in which everybody's very thoughtful and accepts as a given the good faith of their opponents, that seems to me vanishingly unlikely. It's going to be a brutal contest of wills and words. It's going to be very dispiriting for thoughtful members of the public, like normal. You know, society's a pressure cooker. We're the safety release valve. I think we have to face up as politicians to it being tough. But I suppose my view is that it's tough, and it's right that it's tough, but there's a limit.
Well, on that slightly downbeat note, but I hope you will come back and be a guest on the couch another time when we can talk maybe more uplifting topics. Steve Baker, thank you very much for being my guest on the couch.
Thank you, Lucy. Thanks very much.
And thank you all for listening. So please remember to like, subscribe, review, and all the things that help people hear about On The Couch podcast. This is a podcast for Reaction.